And see how, on the one hand, we say, here's all these textual variants. Even if I don't know if it's Jesus or Lord as to what the original is, I know it's got to be this or this. This one I throw out, this one I throw out, this one I throw out. And this last one, the Lord, what I might discover is this is found in one MS is what I'm going to use, which stands for manuscript. One manuscript from, say, the 12th century AD. So it comes 1,100 years after the fact. Or say, you know, probably that one's not going to contain the original wording when all the other manuscripts go in the other direction. Does that make sense to you? In other words, you might hear that we have questions about virtually every word in the New Testament, and on most of those words we have multiple questions as to what the original is. But when you boil it all down to really looking at the evidence, you say, no, we don't have, this is a big problem, but we don't really have much of a question. It's between this and this. These are not options, really. I'm not going to try to beat that to death, but I hope that helps you at least to remove some of the despair. Let me show you a little bit more, though. When you think about what kinds of variants we have, I'm going to put up a chart. By the way, the material I'm giving you is material that I give to Greek students usually, so I just knew that you were some rather intelligent people and I could use this exact same overheads. That's why I've got all the New Testament in Greek, so you'll just learn it during the break, I guess. The vast majority of these 300,000 or 400,000 textual variants are simply spelling changes. The second largest group is going to be changes that would be considered either not viable or no translation difference would result. For example, that last variant I put up there, the Lord, if it's only found in one 12th century manuscript, we have no idea how it got into there, where it skipped all 1,100 years of history, we'd say that's not a viable variant. That manuscript has no claim to authenticity as to what the original said. One way you can think about this, by the way, is this. Think along the lines of genealogies within families. Let's say you've got, you're tracing your own genealogy, and you discover that 10 generations back, your great-great-great-great-great-great, whatever it is, to the 10th power, grandparents had ice blue eyes. And every one of the kids married somebody who had ice blue eyes. And every one of them married someone who had ice blue eyes, right on down the line. Now, if you all of a sudden find that one of the kids somewhere in there has brown eyes, more than likely, well, you may conclude that the child might be adopted. You may conclude that something's going on there that we don't want to talk about. Or you might conclude that, or at least you would not conclude that this person surely reflects what genetically was going on 10 generations back. That's what I'm talking about. If I'm looking at a 12th century manuscript and it's got brown eyes, I'm not going to immediately assume the original must have had brown eyes. See what I'm saying? It's that kind of a, I don't know, you nod your heads fast. You know this stuff so much better than seminary students. It's amazing. I think I'll give you a quiz tomorrow just to check on you. So these are not, a large part is going to be not viable variants, or there's going to be not going to be any translation difference at all. For example, in Greek, they use the word the in front of a proper name. The Jesus. Well, we would never do that in English. That's not English. It's Greek, though. And 20,000 times in the Greek New Testament, the word the occurs. Only about 5,000 of those is it ever translated, but we have to put in the word the in another 12, 15,000 where the Greek doesn't have it for various reasons. In other words, there's not a real correspondence between the two languages. If we have the in front of a proper name, the Paul, the Peter, the Jesus, you can't translate that way. So here's the next largest group of variants that don't affect translation at all. It's not going to change anything at all. The next largest group would be synonyms, where there's no meaning difference. That's the kind of illustration we just looked at in John 4:1. Jesus, Lord, where both of them are synonyms. Finally, and this is rather generous, there may be as much as 1%, actually the best estimate is about 0.1%, which may be itself a little bit high, where we have viable textual variants that do in fact affect the meaning. The number one most common textual variant in the New Testament is something that occurs literally thousands of times, and it's this. Some of you have had Greek, maybe all of two of you, maybe more. So I'm going to put this down for Harry to use. You can have this. It's free. This is not called a movable V. This is a movable nu. And what it means is on the end of verbs in Greek, they would either put an N on the word sometimes or no N, depending on if the next word started with a consonant or a vowel. It's far less significant than the difference between who and whom. It's kind of like the difference between A and An. It's the same general principle. Our oldest manuscripts always put An. It would be that point. Because through the first four centuries of the Christian era, they didn't have the word A. They just didn't use that. Then the manuscripts from the 5th century on started putting A if the following word started with a consonant and if it started with a vowel. That occurs thousands of times, that movable new. That's what it's like, though. You say, gee, that doesn't affect anything at all. And that's exactly right. Okay? I hope that helps you understand that. So we do have a lot of textual variants. Most of them we can completely ignore. I mean, when I say we, those who work in the Greek New Testament, and what we've done in the Net Bible is we've reconstructed the original wording. Is this still on? Okay, I wondered if I went dead. We're trying to reconstruct the original wording of the New Testament, and we have to sift through all this evidence and say, what are the variants that we're going to consider to be even important? What are the manuscripts that we're going to consider to be important as we try to think through what the best representation should be for the original wording? Okay, that's the quantity and the quality of the variants. Let's discuss for a moment, and we're going to go for... Maybe we should take a break right now, so that when we get back into this, we can open right up with Scripture. You like to do that? Let's take a 10-minute break, and we'll come back and look at some verses. Doctrines affected by textual variants. And I'm going to put up here basic thesis that has been proposed since the year 1707 when Professor Bengel in Germany had examined textual variants that had been discovered at that date, and he said no doctrines are affected by any textual variant, period. That was his conclusion almost 300 years ago. Most evangelicals would say no doctrines are affected by any textual variant, even to this day. I have a little bit more of a moderate view where I say no major doctrine, that is no cardinal doctrine, no doctrine that is essential for the faith, is disturbed by any viable variant. Now, I don't want to elevate this to the level of a doctrinal commitment, saying I don't have a verse that says God is going to preserve his word intact 100% down through all the centuries. There really is no verse that says that. There's some verses that people think say that, but it doesn't say that. But I'm going to show you some of the things. We're going to focus on two adjectives here, major and viable. We'll look at a couple of passages and see how these are impacted by this discussion. This is a marvelous testimony, though. It doesn't matter what translation you use, what Greek text stands behind it. No major doctrine is affected by any viable variant. And when I say minor doctrine, I'm talking about something that sometimes would not even qualify as a doctrine. We'll look at two passages real quick, or three real quickly. First of all, look at Matthew chapter 18. This might not be, in fact, an issue of orthodoxy. It might instead be an issue of orthopraxy. That is, right practice, but not necessarily having to do with doctrine. It's an issue that I had to wrestle with a few years ago when I was an interim pastor at a church where the pastor had been dismissed for moral failure, and the deacons had asked me to come and address this issue with them. The pastor, in fact, was a good friend of mine. And we had to wrestle through Matthew chapter 18, verse 15, where it says, if your brother sins against you, go and reprove him between you and him only. And when it says, if your brother sins against you, the two words against you are in doubt. There are some early witnesses that say, if your brother sins, go and reprove him between the two of you. Others say, if your brother sins against you. Now you can see the difference. It can impact how we conduct ourselves with reference to church discipline. But there's no doctrine that's impacted by this. And in fact, we have other verses that seem to clearly indicate if your brother sins, period, that we have a responsibility to address that person. You've got that in Galatians 6, Ephesians 4, and some other references that seem to indicate that. This is a big problem. This is one of the biggest issues that these variants affect. Does that give you a little bit of comfort? We're not going to see all of a sudden, oh my, I don't know if I can believe in the virgin birth anymore. I'm not going to throw any bombshells like that at you because they don't exist. They aren't there. That's an amazing thing. Let me show you another passage. Romans chapter 5, verse 1. I understand you all use a variety of translations in here, and so I decided I'll just read from the Greek text tonight, and that way every time I translate it, it'll sound different, and you'll think I'm looking at two or three of them up here, and one of them will surely be close to yours, I suspect. Romans chapter 5, verse 1. Therefore, having been justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. If you notice that the words we have, or something that's the equivalent of that in your translation, do you have a marginal reading? What does it say? Let us have, yeah. There's, in fact, probably most manuscripts have let us have, and even the earliest manuscripts have let us have, rather than we have peace. This is such a difficult problem that within the New Testament department at Dallas Seminary, which means the Greek department for anyone else, we don't know which way to go on it. There's, I think, six of us to go one route, but the chairman goes a different route, and so, of course, he's right. But, you know, he's my boss, but I don't agree with him here. Harold Hunter thinks that it should read, let us have. The rest of us think it should read, we have. Now, there's actually almost a two-page footnote in the NET Bible explaining why we believe we have is the right translation. There are lots of scientific ways in which we can investigate this. And let me show you two things about this. First of all, in Greek, the difference is not as big as it is in English. Now, this time I am going to write Greek, Harry, so don't correct me. The difference is between echamen and echomen. Or if we did this in English, it would be this way. Not much of a difference, is it? In fact, in first century AD, these words would have been pronounced identically. They would have both been pronounced echomen. And so that's, you know, we're pretty confident that the whichever reading is incorrect arose accidentally from a scribe hearing one letter when he should have written the other. And we've got, I think, some pretty substantial arguments as to why we need to read this as we have rather than let us have. But that's not the issue. The issue here is this. What doctrine is impacted by this? My response would be absolutely none. Is it not true that we as Christians have peace with God? And if it's true, in what sense is it true? It's certainly true forensically or judiciously, you know, that because of the death of Christ, God no longer has wrath towards us. We've been reconciled to Him. Could it also be said that we should have peace with God? Let us have peace with God. In what sense could that be true? Those who take that route say it means let us enjoy peace with God. Let us appreciate the gift that we have. And we know that there's a difference between our position in Christ and our practice. And so one rendering views this as we're dealing with our position in Christ. The other one says, no, we're talking about our practice. There's no doctrine at stake. What is at stake is, what's the pastor going to preach Sunday morning? We have, or let us have. And that is such a significant area for those who work in textual criticism that we will spend a few hundred hours working on a problem like this, trying to determine it, looking at the manuscripts, trying to see what they actually read, because we're concerned for what happens in the churches. But this is a big problem. This is about as big as it gets on these theological issues. Now, let me show you another problem. Take a look at 1 Timothy chapter 3. This one might seem like a bigger problem. We need to clarify some issues here. Paul begins, before he gets into, I think he's quoting from an early Christian hymn that had been written maybe a decade or two earlier than this. And confessedly great is the mystery of godliness, who was manifested in the flesh. I'm sorry, 1 Timothy 3:16. Confessedly great is the mystery of godliness, who was manifest or manifested in the flesh. On that word who, do you have a marginal reading, footnote? Who was manifest in the flesh? Anybody have a King James? What does it say? God was manifest in the flesh, doesn't it? Or God was revealed in the flesh, something like that? Now that is a big difference, isn't it? That's, in fact, an enormous difference. Whether it says who or God. Actually, the difference in Greek, though, I want to show you two things, and you want to set all this in the right perspective so you don't become alarmists. The word who in Greek would have been written like this in the old letters. And the word for God, which was normally written like this, it was called a nomen sacrum, or a sacred name, and they contracted that. They took these two letters out and put a bar over the whole thing. And that told you, that bar said, that's not really what the word is. It's a bigger word than that. But you look at this. Here's who, and here's God, Theos. Now the difference between them is not as great as it would have been this way, right? It's not even any letter difference. It's just a bar above and a bar in the middle. And I've looked at some of the manuscripts, some of these old manuscripts. I've spent a couple hours looking at one where I tried to see what the original handwriting said, because it had been rubbed over so many times. We think it probably said who, then somebody later wrote it in here and wrote the bar above, then somebody later came and erased that, then somebody later, a few centuries down the line, came and wrote it again. It's a little bit of a tricky operation. But let me get to the theological issue. There's no doctrine that's at stake here. If there's a doctrine that's at stake here, that would mean that this is, if it says God was manifest in the flesh, this is a strong affirmation of the deity of Christ. The question I have for you is this. Does the deity of Christ depend on this verse? If you didn't have this verse, does that, oh, shucks, I got to throw out the deity of Christ. I can't believe that he's God in the flesh. Of course not. It may be that there are some verses that we need to understand differently than we had understood before. But it doesn't change a doctrine unless all of the verses that affirm the deity of Christ, all of a sudden there's textual variance for, and we have to change the wording on those. But that's not the case. This is the biggest one I know of. That makes sense? Okay, good. I hope that's encouraging to you. You really have to take it by faith that those who work in this field know what they're doing, and I'm trying to give you illustrations. We could go through all 400,000 textual variants tonight, but you know, we couldn't do it tonight, but then you'd really see that what I'm saying is true. But I hope you can at least realize that there's a plausibility of this being a good way to approach it. Point C, the early manuscripts and modern translations. There's kind of a myth out there about early manuscripts and how they relate to the translation. This is a myth that, in fact, I was on the John Ankerberg show 3 years ago. I think that show has been aired several times since, about which Bible is the best translation to use today. And there were three representatives of the King James and Dr. Art Farstad, the senior translator for the New King James Bible. And as we discussed the issue about these translations that we have, one of these gentlemen who was an advocate of the King James said, well, you know, the King James is authentic. It goes back to earlier manuscripts because it was done 400 years ago, and therefore it goes back to manuscripts that are older. And then when you look at the later ones, like the Revised Version of 1881 or the NIV of 1973, they're not based on those ancient manuscripts. They're based on more recent ones. That was his myth. That's what he thought was true. Or sometimes people put a different spin on it, where they say, every time I get another translation of the Bible, what they've done is just look at the previous English Bibles, but it's not really a new translation. That's also a myth. That's not true. Scholars are looking at the original languages every time they do a translation. This is how it's perceived. This is the reality of it, though, that we know the manuscripts, for the most part, that the King James translation was based on. It was based on about 6 manuscripts from about the 12th century, 10th to the 13th century, but the majority of them were from the 12th century. They were at the University of Basel. One of them now is housed in Dublin. It's even got a name, but we won't discuss those issues. By 1881, almost 300 years later, we had discovered 2,000 manuscripts of the New Testament. The earliest of which went back to the 4th century. We had a couple of major manuscripts that went all the way back to the 4th century. That's 600 years earlier than the manuscripts that the King James translation used, and 800 years earlier than the ones they normally used. By 1973, we had nearly 5,000 manuscripts that were used, the earliest of which went all the way back into the 2nd century. Now, 1998, we have 5,500 Greek manuscripts. We keep finding more manuscripts, and the earliest still goes back to the 2nd century, but we have more of them that are going back to that time period. That's remarkable. As time goes on, we don't lose the manuscripts that were used before. We still have those, and we have a whole bunch more, and they're earlier than the ones that were used before. So it's when you think about our modern translations, don't think of them as like that illustration I used earlier, that somehow something's lost in the translation from one person spreading a rumor to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. It's not that the modern translations are 12 links back to the King James, which somehow was based on the original. Modern translations bypass all that, and they go back to the original manuscripts. Now, to be sure, they look at the these other translations, but they're going back to the Greek and the Hebrew. And more ancient Greek and Hebrew manuscripts than ever before. That makes sense? That should help you, that we're moving really towards greater certainty about the text. Point D, the date of New Testament books and early papyri. This is just a wonderful thing to realize, and I'm going to pass out an exact duplicate of a papyrus. This actually is made on papyrus. This is from what's called papyrus number 66. It's in the Bodmer collection. This is, the real thing is housed in Geneva. And I had somebody in Dallas took real papyri, and you know, papyri is basically it's like strips of banana leaves that are laid out, and then you put some others at a 90 degree angle and beat them against each other, and you got some really rough kind of paper. That's what papyrus is like. In fact, if you're ever wanting to know if you've got a real papyrus, taste it. If it tastes like banana, you know somebody's done something wrong, because that's how they make a counterfeit papyri, is with banana leaves. But it's about the texture of a grocery bag, and I asked this person to write out exactly what one of our earliest papyri has in John chapter 7. This is a manuscript that dates from about AD 175. So it's a 2nd century manuscript, not our earliest one. But it's got almost all the... And I'm going to pass this out to you so you can take a look at it, and just don't take it out of the plexiglass. But it's on both sides. Do you have any thieves in your congregation, Harry, or do you think I'll get this back? Okay, good. Well, you see that? That's just one leaf of this papyrus. P66 is what scholars designate it as. Let me tell you about the value of these papyri and what they do for us when we think about the New Testament. In the year 1844, there was a German scholar at the University of Tübingen by the name of Ferdinand Christian Bauer, and he has sometimes been called the father of modern theological liberalism. Bauer followed Hegel's philosophy about how to think about history. And Hegel, as you all got in college, started out with that great little line about you have a thesis, you get an antithesis, and then between the thesis and the antithesis, you get a synthesis. You remember all that? F.C. Bauer applied that to the New Testament. And he wrote in the year 1844 in the Tübinger Jahrbuch that John's Gospel must have been written sometime after the year A.D. 160. Well, if it's written after 160, more than likely it's not written by John the Apostle. I don't think he lived that long, and it must not have a whole lot of stuff that's historically accurate in it. You know, and so scholars, ever since 1844, decided John's Gospel is absolutely worthless, liberal scholars, that is, absolutely worthless for any historical reliability on the life of Jesus. Well, fast forward to 1935. There's a student at Manchester University working in the John Rylands Library, and his name is Colin H. Roberts. He's in his 20s. He's still alive today, by the way, which means that if you're a textual critic, you live forever. That's why I chose this field. And C.H. Roberts was rummaging through some of the papyri that had been excavated from Egypt from 15 years earlier in the basement of John Rylands Library. In these great European libraries, they've got just piles of ancient scraps of papyri very similar to this, or in worse shape than this, that have never been examined closely enough to know what they're from. We've found over 50,000 papyri so far in Egypt that have been published, and I think another 150,000 that have not been published. They're just sitting in these libraries in Europe because there's not enough workers to work on it. C.H. Roberts was not a New Testament scholar. He was a papyrologist. And he comes across this one fragment that's no bigger than the palm of my hand that comes from John chapter 18. And he looks at that fragment. This is P52 is what I want you to write down, because you need to at least have one biblical document you've ever thought about, and that's the one. Here he looked at the thing, and he started reading some lines on one side, and he noticed it was verses 31 through 33 in large measure of John chapter 18. I mean, there were some holes in it and moth holes and that kind of thing. He flipped it over, and he saw John chapter 18, verses 37 and 38. Now, obviously, it didn't have the chapter and verses, you know, but what it had was the Greek words, and he knew that it must be from the Gospel of John. He sent that document, that one fragment, couldn't find anything else that went with it. Obviously, it came from the Gospel of John, a whole book on it, but that was not a very big book. But he couldn't find the rest of it. It had never been excavated. It was destroyed, apparently. But he sent that one fragment to the world's leading papyrologists in Europe. There were three different ones, one in Germany, and I forgot where the other two were. But they all, independently of one another, came back, sent the papyrus back to him, and they said, this should be dated absolutely no later than AD 150 and as early as AD 100. There were some others who said, we think it should be dated into the 90s of the first century. Here's the point. If you have F.C. Bauer over here who says the Gospel of John could not have been written until after 160, and then you have a copy of the Gospel of John that could not have been written after 150. Somebody's wrong, right? You can't have a copy of something before the original, 10 years before the original. It doesn't work that way. This copy proved forever that F.C. Bauer's thesis was wrong. And as one Wag put it, it sent 2 tons of German scholarship to the flames, that one little papyrus. That's what working in these manuscripts does for us. That's why scholars work in this material, and they discover things that are absolutely remarkable. By the way, C.H. Roberts, I just want to give you a little side note about him. He has gone on and he's written a book called The Birth of the Codex. Do you all know what a codex is? It's this thing here. It's what we call a book. What they used to call a book was a scroll. C.H. Roberts, with another fellow who's in his 90s, T.C. Skeet, who used to be the head librarian at the British Museum, these guys really do live forever. I just got to stay in this field. They wrote a book called The Birth of the Codex, and they examined all these manuscripts, and the conclusion they came to was this. The codex form itself, when books move from scroll to the kind that we have where it's got a spine and then you got pages that you flip over, started in Antioch of Syria in about AD 50. Their belief is that Christians invented the Codex. And certainly, if Christians did not invent the Codex, they have absolute proof that Christians were the ones who promoted the use of the Codex through the first five centuries, Christian centuries. So if somebody ever says, you Christians are so backwards, you say, wait a minute, backwards? What do you call this? You know, we're forward-thinking. We did one thing, you know, the book. So what's interesting is all of our manuscripts of the New Testament, every single one of them is written on both sides. And almost all of them are on a codex. All of them except maybe five or six are on a codex. The reason they're written on both sides, we don't know, except that codexes or codices were almost never written on both sides. They were written just on one side because you've got these papyrus leaves that you're laying out this way and then others going this way. You've got one side that you can write on, the horizontal side, right? The other side, where it's going to be vertical, you can't keep writing across that. It's just going to, it's real hard to do. But all the New Testament copies we have were written on both sides. And the suggestion is that this shows something about the social class of Christians. They were poor. They had to write on both sides. There's remarkable things that working in this field has helped us to understand. And I really get thrilled when I think about some of these great scholars who've gone before who have a profound dedication to Jesus Christ. Quite frankly, that's what motivates many of them. And they make these discoveries that are just absolutely amazing. One little papyrus fragment that sends 2 tons of German scholarship to the flames. E, the theory of multiple editions of various New Testament books and early papyri. I think we'll just skip that, and I'm just going to tell you something basic. Here's a basic principle I want to tell you, and that is liberal scholarship also often comes up with a lot of, well, we're not going to skip it then, I guess, but we'll skip some of the details. But liberal scholarship often comes up with a lot of, quite frankly, harebrained schemes about how the Bible was put together. And sometimes they'll say, well, I think John's gospel came out in 6 or 7 different editions, and these chapters were transposed between this and this. And they kind of give those arguments that we don't have any evidence against it, so therefore it must be true, kind of a thing. And they come up with all sorts of reasons why that must be the case. The Jesus seminar that you've heard about, that where they voted on whether Jesus said something or not, had this kind of a mentality to it. The reason why this stuff happens is because of this. It really gets back to the education in the three major countries of Christian thought, Germany, England, and America. And there's a little ditty that goes like this about the scholarship in those three countries. The Germans invented, namely, a brand new idea. The Germans create it. The British correct it. And the Americans corrupt it. It gets back to the education we have in our countries. In Germany, they study philosophy. Why? Because they're landlocked, and they don't want to study history. That's not a good thing for Germany to look at their own history. The British study and love history. The British Museum is a great monument to British imperialism. I mean, it's they study history because they're the victors. And Americans, we watch TV. That's why you get the Germans to create these weird ideas, and they always get it from philosophers in the German universities that are completely untested against the empirical data of history. Then you get the British who come along and say, you know, I'm not sure that's really going to fly. Here's why. Here's some evidence out there that suggests you're wrong. So these weird German ideas fall shipwreck constantly on the rocks of textual criticism, of early textual evidence. And here's the line I want you to remember. An ounce of evidence is worth a pound of presumption. An ounce of evidence is worth a pound of presumption. There's a lot of presumption that goes on in biblical studies from the liberal side of things. But if you have an ounce of evidence, you can have a little fragment that sends 2 tons of German scholarship to the flames. The reliability of New Testament manuscripts in relation to other ancient documents. So this is really a very important issue. And I've got a handout on this that I'm going to give to you at just the right time. And I'll ask one of these 2 gentlemen up here if you'd pass this out when I ask for it. Here's what is often said. Someone says, you admit that you don't have the originals of the New Testament anymore. How then do you know that somebody named Jesus ever even lived? How do you know that somebody named the Apostle Paul ever lived? How do you know that anything that you have in that Bible of yours is true at all? Get rid of all the miracles. How do we know that King David ever lived? For the old, you know, you've got those kinds of questions. What's interesting is when you begin to study other literature, you start noticing how strong the case is for the scriptures. And in fact, it's absolutely mind-boggling how strong it is. Let me show you. I've got it here someplace. Here it is. Here's some work that had been done by a great scholar by the name of F.F. Bruce. He died a few years ago because he was not a textual critic.